I'm Marcy Howard, and for the next hour, we're going to have a discussion about faith. The mission of About Faith is to gain peace and understanding with one another through answering questions about a variety of faiths. We are not here to debate right or wrong. We're here to gain knowledge and understanding of one another through respectful conversations with faith leaders about their own journey with faith. So let me introduce our panel today. We have Rabbi Jana.
How are you? From B'nai Zion Congregation in Shreveport. Good to see you.
And we have Father Jason.
Hey, Marcy. Hey, Rabbi. I'm Father Jason. I'm at Holy Nativity of the Lord Orthodox Mission in Shreveport.
I'm really happy to have you here today. And we've got an interesting topic. We're going to discuss foods of faith.
Which is so appropriate.
And so the first question I have for you today is, what are some foods that are important in your faith?
Father, I'm going to let you go first on this one.
Okay, yeah. You know, being from the South, every food is important to your faith, right? Tried a couple of times, is they're all important. But I would say, you know, at the heart of our worship as Orthodox Christians, bread and wine would be the most important as a central aspect of our faith, because how we understand that is we offer it up to God and what it becomes to us, the body and blood of Christ. So I would say it's central to our worship. Then there's also...
Father, may I ask a question about that?
Absolutely.
I feel like it's an interesting... You've got to make a distinction that to some extent, when you consider it the body and blood, then it becomes a non-food. I don't think that, you know, I think that it, so I don't know. That's my question a little bit. It's not really a food anymore.
Yeah, we call it an unbloody sacrifice. Okay. In the sense that, let's just say if we take a trip back into the time of Genesis, in the very beginning, we see that one of the main issues that Adam and Eve have with God relates to food, right? And so from the earliest times of biblical history, we see that food is incredibly important as it relates to communing with God. And so we see a fast is implemented there. You can eat of anything but this tree. And so food itself, because God made man and woman hungry. And so the ultimate desire for that is they become hungry for him, not just physically, but there's a spiritual hunger as well. So if you can continue on through the Hebrew Bible, and you know this better than I do, and this is in any ancient religion, meals are incredibly important. And sacrifice itself isn't necessarily just the killing of an animal. That's a byproduct of the meal that is shared in the presence of God. And so meals themselves, that type of idea of food and communion with God carries through. And so for us, when you get into the Eucharist, we would say the Lord's Supper, what we're doing is the same thing. We're sharing a meal with God, as was in the time of the Hebrew scriptures, during the time of the temple period and other ancient religions. The difference is the food that we consume now is Christ himself, Jesus himself for us. He becomes our food. And so in that, when we consume him, we say he consumes us and we become a chalice to the world. That's our hope, that by partaking of us, they partake of him. So that's kind of a summary of why we would understand the sacrament itself as being food and drink, because we do consume it.
It's a you are what you eat situation.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So I had an interesting part of the reason why I have come to understand the Christian idea of consuming body and blood. I was teaching a liturgy class, and a Hebrew liturgy class. And most of my students are Christian while I'm in Shreveport for many, many years now. And I had Catholic women in my class, and a couple weeks after I taught the blessing for bread and the blessing for wine, because we have blessings we say before we eat.
Right.
There's a commandment that you're supposed to bless the food out. You're supposed to bless the meal after you eat. That's another story. So we have blessings for bread and we have blessings for wine. And one student called to say, hey, guess what? The other student, she had a situation where she was saying the blessings for the sacrament, and she said the blessing for bread, and she said the blessing for wine. And I say, hey, that's really cool. I'm very proud that I taught her that, because I believe that Jesus would have said those blessings before Jesus ate or drank the wine. And because the blessings are that old, that I believe that that Jesus would have said that. And the woman who called me said, no, that's terrible. Because by the time she's eating it, and these women were Catholic, by the time she's eating it, it's not bread and it's not wine anymore. It's, you know, been, what's it called?
The Roman Catholic tradition, transubstantiation.
Transubstantiation. So she was trying to say that. And all of a sudden I'm like, what would be the blessing for eating blood and body? What would that blessing be before you eat? And it's a different kind of a process, because it's not, like you were saying, I think that there's like a distinction between eating and consuming and being. I think that there's and it was a very mind-blowing, mind-opening experience for me to hear why she was wrong to say the motzi and the kiddush for those two things.
Yeah, I think if you go back and look, some of the earliest, you know, I think you point out something too, Rabbi, that's incredibly important. When you think of sacrifice in the Hebrew Bible, quite often everybody's mind goes to a whole burnt offering or an animal. But like you said, there were other sacrifices that had nothing to do with blood. There were grain offerings or whatever else it may be. So really those were, when you think sacrifice, we would think meal, not just the shedding of blood, right?
And blood wasn't, in the Jewish tradition, blood wasn't consumed. God would say that we had to eliminate the blood before we could eat if it were an animal. But
because life's in the blood, right?
And I like to say the translation about sacrifice, and I have said this before here with you, that to me, sacrifice isn't what you give up. Sacrifice is what you give up. It's about making something sacred. Right. It's not about the things that we give up, which... when we talk about food and fasting, Marcy, that's a really big part of it. I also, when I read the sections in the Hebrew scriptures in the Torah about offerings, I try not to translate it as sacrifice at all. It's not, the focus is not on the taking the life, although the fact that we take it for a holy purpose does give it a you know, sacred meaning. And I think of it as korban, for example. The word in Hebrew comes from the word karov, which means to get closer to. It's a way of getting closer to God. And I've been thinking a lot about the concept of the foods that we eat and the foods that we don't eat, and how those things help us to feel closer to God, to feel that, you know, God commands us to be holy. And it's one of the ways that we get to be holy, which is another whole conversation. What does holy mean? That's one that blows my mind too. I appreciate these insights about food, and especially that. And I like the idea about the meal, and I like the idea about being human means having an appetite about having to eat. I guess I never thought of it that way before. I think of being human as all living... The blessing that we say after the meal, we have this teeny tiny version for kids that goes like this: all living things need food. Thank you, God, source of food for all. Baruch atah. And I'm going to say Ad Hashem. I'm not going to say God's name in this part because I didn't just finish eating. I don't say a blessing for something if I haven't done the thing. Baruch atah Ad Hashem hazan et hakol, which is thank you, God, you for the one who feeds everything. And so I think of it as all living things require sustenance, and that God provides that sustenance, whatever it is.
We have a post-meal prayer as well that echoes that. We give thanks to thee, O Christ, our God, for thou hast satisfied us with the earthly blessings, deprive us not also of the heavenly kingdom. As thou would come to the disciples and grant them peace, so come to us and save us, O Savior. So we say that after the meal when we eat as well. But going back to what you said about my whole point in that is to show the continuity between, you know, ancient Judaism and early Christianity, how really early Christianity was just another Jewish sect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the first century, really.
We still like to call it, I mean, some people get mad at me when I say this. I had a Catholic friend who said that she was a completed Jew, which I thought was a very sweet way of looking at it because it means that she appreciated and valued her Jewish roots. Some people get offended by that. I call it like Judaism 2.0 now with new and improved whatever. And it does not hurt my feelings at all to imagine that our foundation is the same for both faiths. And it doesn't hurt my feelings at all to know that we've gone in some ways into different directions. And in some ways we keep all of the same values. And I think that when we remember that we have the same values as our basis, I hope that it's a good reason to be able to respect each other more. The fact that we do things differently shouldn't hurt our feelings.
But going back again, forgive me. But there is a early Christian document, first century, arguably, I would say first century, called the Didache, and it's called the Teaching of the Two Ways. But within it, we see early Eucharist, Lord's Supper, we would say. And in it, it contains the prayers before and after, especially referring to the wine. So it's a very Jewish text. Berakoth prayers, am I saying it correctly?
So it would be bracha is a blessing. Brachot are the, is the plural.
You know, I can't say it that way.
You can't chuch. You have no chuching. Oh, man.
Yeah, but those prayers are included in this document, which is incredibly important. As we see the development of that rite or that spiritual practice within the church. Yeah.
So that's why there was such a division between Judaism and Christianity, because Christians couldn't stop being able to chuch. I think that's what the problem was. Right. I got to teach you to chuch, and then we'll all be on the same page again.
We'll get together and work on it. We may see some.
I'm sorry to tell you that after the age of about 10, your ability to make new sounds consistently kind of you get lost. That's why everybody keeps the same accent after a certain stage and things. So
well, a lot of people tell me I can't speak English fluently anyway, so I'm working on that at the moment, you know.
Maybe you can trick them and you can tell them you're speaking Hebrew and then you're covered.
Yeah.
Can I get back on track here? Are there any foods that have special instructions in your faith of what to do with them?
Well, that's part of, in Jewish tradition, there are a number of restrictions and guidelines about food. You've heard of keeping kosher. So in the Torah, in the Hebrew scriptures, it mentions specific animals that you cannot eat and some that you can eat. So the guidelines are for keeping kosher. And one of them is no blood. But the guidelines are that if you have a four-legged animal, it has to have cloven hooves, split hoof, and it has to chew its cud. And if it's a bird, it essentially comes down to no birds of prey, only kind of what we're going to call them. I mean, it's pigeons and chickens and turkeys are okay, but vultures and eagles and falcons are not. The Torah mentions some names of birds, but some of the names connected to which specific bird has been lost over time. But it does feel like all the category of birds that we can eat are not the kinds that are either attackers or the garbage feeders, like a vulture. And then a similar kind of a guideline for things in the water. We can eat fish with fins and scales, but we're not supposed to eat anything like the crustaceans and things we're not allowed to eat. Or believe it or not, how can you live in Louisiana and not eat shrimp and not eat mud bugs and not eat catfish? You go into a restaurant and it says it's got fish tacos and they're catfish and I can't eat them.
Tilapia?
Yes, I do. Tilapia, I do. I do. Okay. I do a lot.
Okay.
And then if it's a bug, there are certain bugs we're allowed to eat, insects. It has to do with the kind of legs and the kind of things. But I like to say, I don't care what the guidelines are. I'd really rather not eat any bugs if I intentionally, and not to offend anybody. And so this is an important thing that I like to say too. Being holy, there's a whole history of how I feel about being holy. When you're little, you think of holy as like super duper, extremely better than, but I don't think of holy as that anymore. I think of it somewhat as different, set apart. And so if I don't eat those foods, then I'm different than the people who do, but it doesn't make me better. It's not super duper better than, it's just different. I liken it to, you know, if bedtime in my house is 10, but bedtime next door is 11, it doesn't make us better than anybody. It's just different. That's just the way we do things. But we're different if we don't eat these things. And then the next guideline is, it says you shouldn't boil the calf in the mother's milk. And so there's a tradition about that that's come to never having dairy and meat together in the same meal or course or plate. There are ways of having like a dairy first course, but some people wait 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours. Some people wait 6 hours after having dairy before they can have meat, so that they're keeping that tradition. But then, and this is coming up soon for us, by the end of the month, we will be in Passover. That's another restriction time where it says that we are obligated to have matzah for 7 days, and we are obligated not to have chametz, which is kind of the opposite of matzah, for 7 days. These are things that are fall into a category of certain, made by with certain grains or rise. The word chametz kind of literally means ferments. It's not anything that ferments, it's specific grains that ferment. And we're not allowed to have them. We're not even allowed to own them. So I've already started this process of kind of clean stripping my house of everything that might be chametz has already begun. And so food and what you eat and don't eat, there's also, a kind of an informal tradition about a different kind of food that's traditional for each of our holidays and holy days. And some of that is out of necessity. And some of that is like, if it's a harvest festival, which each of the biblical feasts, holy days are connected also to, they're connected to historical events, but they're also connected to time-bound things, which harvest is coming up at which time. And so it's traditional to do things like that. Or for example, there's a holiday, Shavuot, which means weeks, which is 7 weeks after Passover, which is connected to Pentecost, the 50th day. And it's usually a dairy holiday. And the reason for that is we were standing at Sinai, we were waiting for the commandments, the Torah, the Decalogue, we're waiting for that. And we were not sacrificing animals during that moment while we were standing and waiting for. So it's traditional to eat dairy because we wouldn't have been sacrificing animals. There is a tradition that says, like Father was kind of alluding to, there's a tradition that says that the only time we were eating meat was if we were using it as a holy offering as well. And there was a time when the only place that we were doing offerings was either the tabernacle when we were traveling for those 40 years, or once the temple was built in Jerusalem at the temple. That was the only time we were doing meat meals. So yes, food is very connected to Judaism.
Rabbi, I have a question that I've always had, and now I'm going to take the opportunity to ask it. there's lots of different reasons I've been told that there were animals you could eat or animals you couldn't eat. And all the reasons were things that kind of made sense, but I wasn't sure that's the real reason. Why are there animals you can eat and animals you can't eat?
Well, I'm going to get curious here for a second. What are some of the reasons why you can imagine, what were things you heard that were compelling reasons?
Well, one of the reasons I was told was because there wasn't any refrigeration. And so the animals that could spoil quickly or not be kept in any way at that time was a suggestion. So it was a loving thing that God did to say, oh, don't eat that.
Because it's not as healthy. Yeah. And that is that. So I'm going to tell you, the awesome thing about God is that when God commands us to do things, it turns out that they're usually way better for us. Those commandments are better. And health reasons has been a very legitimate suggestion about why throughout the ages, for 4,000 years already. And there are many scholars who have very convincingly suggested, kind of for what you said, other things, trichinosis, the garbage eaters, I call them, like the vultures and the bottom feeders in the ocean, in the waters, the catfish that are eating the bottom, the cleaners, whatever, their stomachs are designed to be able to handle that. But when you eat it, your stomach isn't really designed to handle all the crud that they've been eating. So it's not as healthy for you. There's all kinds of reasons that I can give you why all of those animals that are forbidden are less healthy. But my problem with, and I believe that God wants us to eat to be healthy, but my problem with thinking of that as the reason is that it means that God said, psst, come here, I want the Jews to be healthy. I don't care if anybody else eats crud. I don't care. And I don't think that that's the way life works. I don't think that's how God works. I think, like I said before, I am very glad. It would be awesome if the whole world listened to the fact that God said, eat these things and not these things, because these things are more healthy for you. It would be glorious if God, if the world listened to what Hebrew scripture said, but I'm not convinced that that's what it is. So what else? What else have you got? Healthy is good. We stay healthy if we keep kosher, but we also have to salt all of our meat to drain all the blood. And sometimes eating that much salt is not as healthy. So that's a positive and negative. What's another reason you heard about keeping kosher?
Availability.
Let me tell you, kosher meat is always significantly more expensive. And do you know where you could get kosher meat in Shreveport?
Well, I get kosher hot dogs at Kroger.
That's right. You can get kosher hot dogs anywhere. And let me tell you something along the lines of healthy. If you get a kosher hot dog and it says it's all beef, that means that it is not 92% beef. It means it is 100%. As it said in a great advertising campaign, we answer to a higher authority. American laws allow you to, they're very careful about what goes into food, but you're allowed to have other ingredients in an all beef hot dog if you're not kosher. But if you keep a kosher house, then you have to have whatever it says in there. Promise you, it's 100% whatever that is. So there's very little kosher meat available in Shreveport ever. So Dallas is the closest kosher food. Metairie has a place called Kosher Cajun. And it's significantly more expensive to get kosher food. So availability is a terrible reason. It's a great reason to be vegan or vegetarian, because if you're vegan, then you're always keeping kosher.
And kosher doesn't just mean the type of beef or meat. It also means how it was slaughtered, correct?
Exactly. It has to be slaughtered. And what I'm going to say, even though we're referring to animals, I'm going to call it a humane way. That animal is not supposed to feel fear or pain. The knife has to be perfectly sharp, and you go so that you're cutting both of the veins here. And then it gets drained of all of the blood, like I said, and then it gets salted. If you see kosher salt in the store, it doesn't mean that this box of salt is kosher and the box next to it is not kosher. There's nothing not kosher about the salt sitting there. There's even bacon flavored salt, and there's usually nothing real bacon in there. So it's usually kosher. And you can tell if it's kosher. There are symbols on boxes in America on the food. Like if you have a U with an O around it, that means that the Union of Orthodox Rabbis has deemed that this is kosher. And much of the food that you eat is already kosher. I had this adorable situation with the kids one day that we were working at the summer camp, and it was my job to tell the kids that this is what's for lunch today. Who wants whatever the lunch menu is, and who wants peanut butter and jelly? And so the kids, I said, we're having kosher hot dogs today. One kid said, like, I don't know if I should eat that because I don't keep kosher. And I said, wait, what'd you have for breakfast today? And they said, Cheerios. And I said, Cheerios is kosher. You know, what'd you have? And most of the food that they ate was kosher, and they didn't realize it. But you're right. So it's not just the animal specifically, but it's also the way that they are slaughtered and prepped. So the kosher salt is the salt. It's got bigger grains to it, and it's better at absorbing the blood from it. It's also really good when you have an ice storm for sprinkling on the steps. It'll melt the ice better than regular salt, than table salt. But there are other guidelines about how you slaughter it. And usually, at least where I grew up, you don't go and find a cow and slaughter it yourself. There are people who are trained to do that. And let me tell you, and I'm sorry that we didn't have an imam on today, there are many, the laws about halal are similar, sometimes identical to the Jewish laws about keeping kosher and slaughtering animals. There are communities around the world where in order for the Jews and the Muslims to eat anything, they buy cows together and then they slaughter them together to make sure that the laws for both are being kept. And it's a kind of a glorious thing. So my answer, by the way, Marcy, which in the end we didn't answer it. I appreciated your insights. We don't know. It's the God said so thing. I actually, my reason for keeping kosher are similar to, based on, I'm going to say what Father Jason was saying. And that is that I am a living creature and I have to eat. If every single thing that I do, every choice that I make, I think faith and being human is about choices you make. If every single choice that I make is one that includes God in it, then I feel like I'm living a holy life. I have to eat to survive. And so every time I put any food in my mouth, I'm thinking about, did God say this was okay to eat or not? I am not just being a living creature, but I am living a holier life by making a choice every single time. So I don't know what the reason, that's the point in the Torah. It doesn't tell us why we have to do this, but that's why I do it. God said so.
Father Jason, are there any things in your faith journey that are special instructions about food, like that the rabbi was talking about?
Yeah, the real, I guess this time of year, especially looking at fasting. And so we're in what's known as cheese fair right now. So this week we can have dairy products, eggs, milk, etc. Sunday was the last day that we could have meat. And so we're entering into this time of the 40-day fast, which really lasts more like 50 days. Mm-hmm. It gets us to Holy Week, and then the fasting gets more intense. But this coming Sunday at midnight, and then we follow the Jewish idea of time. When the sun sets, it's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But for convenience sake, and because we live in the Western world that we're in, we just say midnight. But for us, after we do our evening service, it's the next day. Mm-hmm. Evening and morning, a new day, right, Rabbi?
Exactly.
So at midnight, we'll no longer be eating meat or dairy. And so that's how we fast. It's really fruit and vegetables. It's a healthy way of dieting, actually, a healthy way to formulate your food choices. So we end up eating a lot of pasta and get really bloated if we're not careful, okay?
So, that's what happens at Passover. If all we're eating is matzah, I eat
a lot of
way more matzah than I eat bread. I mean, it's really
a lot of bread. So that goes into Pascha night, which for us, you know, in the Western church, we say Easter, or they say Easter. We say Pascha, which is really Passover.
Which is Hebrew, is Pesach. I'm sorry, there's a chach in there, but it's no. Pesach is Pasqua. And yeah. I'm sorry, Pasqua in Italiano, but and it's Pasqua in Spanish. It's, I mean, it's Pesach, which is pretty cool.
The etymology is the same. Mm-hmm. And we just calculate the date differently on how we celebrate Pascha itself for us, the resurrection, we would say. So that, then after that, though, it, you know, the service that night starts about 10:30 at night. It goes about 1:30 in the morning or 2:00 in the morning, and then we eat whatever. You know, there's barbecue, there's eggs, there's a, I'm going to give a shout out to a lady named Ruth Taylor, who makes what we call a Pascha. And basically it's an incredibly expensive 4 or 5 day to make pyramid of a cheesecake type thing.
And that's called a Pascha also?
Yeah, they call it the Pascha. You know, it really doesn't have any relation to Pascha itself. It's just they refer to that probably because that's the only time you eat it.
And I would have thought that. So the Paschal lamb is some of what the connection was. What Pesach was the springtime offering was lamb.
A lot of people eat a lamb. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that takes place. And really, that it takes on local traditions as well. We have the capital T traditions and the little T traditions, right? Capital T, everybody's doing little T, well, we may throw more Tony Sacheres on certain than other people do, right? So, but outside of our normal fasting, which we fast on Wednesdays and Fridays during the normal course of the year as well, from meat and dairy, there is certain things that are made at different times of during church life. Every week there is a loaf that is made. Mm-hmm. In the Russian tradition, there's five. We're calling the five loaves and two fishes. In the Byzantine Greek tradition, it's one loaf. And a family will make that loaf of bread. It has a certain seal on it. There are prayers that go along with it. And then they bring it to me. And that is what I use for the Holy Eucharist during the service on Sunday, the Divine Liturgy, the Lord's Supper. So that's cut and prepared a certain way. And then what is left is cut into pieces and shared among the people. It almost takes the form of what the agape meal was back in the very, very early church period, which now we would say kind of carries over to the parish hall after the service proper. And so that bread is consumed. We also have a...
Is there a name for that bread, Father?
It's called a prosphoro, from offering up. Yeah, prosphoro.
I wonder if it's a parallel to challah. We have challah. We have bread that's, fancier bread on Shabbat that's a braided bread, and it's challah. And it sounds like this similar love goes into making it and sharing it.
Yeah, and then for both of us, it goes back to the shoe bread and the ancient...
And the tabernacle in the temple.
Tabernacle, yeah. So all this kind of ties together. Mm-hmm. Then there's another...
And may I, Father, for a moment, since I interrupted already, forgive me, but the challah that we have on Shabbat and on other holidays is also connected to the manna that was collected while we were in the wilderness. Sure. So there's a tradition sometimes about having two loaves, because on Fridays we had to collect a double portion of manna. So there's a connection to that as well. We remember that.
And we have theological themes tying back to manna, our Christological themes tying back to the manna.
Manna is the Hebrew word. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I appreciate you translating for me.
I don't know if I said it right or not.
That was good. No, that was very good.
Hey, I follow you when anything with Hebrew comes up, I would rather reference you on those things.
I got the Hebrew down, but that English that you speak that maybe some people think is not English.
Yes.
I'm a Yankee officially. I'm from New York. I've lived down here since 1992. So some of the words that I say are my pronunciations I need help on too. So I appreciate that, y'all.
You actually enunciate and pronounce words. Sometimes I do not.
Which doesn't make it better. I don't know. Well, I was going to say, by the way, this is a very horrible aside, I guess, but to interrupt with this, when you mentioned Tony's, I saw this, one of my favorite memes from the snowpocalypse that we just experienced in Shreveport, the week of intense ice and snow. Someone said, well, if we're supposed to put salt on our sidewalks, are we supposed to put Tony's on it too? And that was one of my favorite memes of the
week. That's really good. Tony's may do better.
I'm saying it's pretty hot. It could work.
It's good stuff.
Sorry.
The other, Marcy, is, and I'm trying to think of other times during the year. I mean, there's certain things, like I said, that are local traditions, but we also have it's made of wheat and raisins and other herbs and white almonds, white chocolate covered almonds.
You get me hungry, Father. What is this?
That sound good? It's called kolava. And we use it for memorials for people after, when they pass away, when they repose 40 days later, we do a memorial for them. And quite often we have this with kolava. And then it's definitely part of the tradition to do that every year on the day that we remember their passing.
So we have a Yahrzeit tradition, which is the year time also. And we have, I'm glad you mentioned that, because when Marcy mentioned that we'd be talking about food and fasting today, I wasn't thinking about the tradition for, there is a meal that you prepare for someone who is in mourning. When their immediate relative dies, the first meal that they come to, and we're supposed to feed them, they're not supposed to, like, we go to their house to help them. They're not supposed to get ready, you know, prepare a feast for us. And the first meal is a hard-boiled egg, traditionally. That wow. It's really simple. You don't have to think about it. It's not like you're forcing them to eat a lot or anything. And it's healthy enough to give you energy to keep going. And it also is kind of a symbol, as you can imagine, because Pascha, Easter, Passover, all coming up, and egg is a symbol for all of them about yeah. kind of a circle of life thing.
Yeah, so. And Marcy, you could take this in all kinds of directions, but and I think you would see this in Second Temple Judaism and probably even before, but there was this mindset throughout the ancient world of eating meals with the departed. Not that you're feeding them, but in remembrance of them. Refrigerium meals, or we see that a lot in the first, second century, really second century, where even in the Roman traditions where you have the catacombs, quite often people would go and have a meal on the sarcophagus or where someone was buried, and they would be sharing a meal with the departed. In some traditions, people will go and actually put plates on graves of people. And then in the early Christian tradition, in the catacombs, again, the Divine Liturgy, the Holy Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, however you want to state it, was celebrated in the same way on top of the sarcophagus or coffin or where the person was departed, quite often the day that they were martyred or the day that they died. So there's a lot of history here in this, you know,
death related.
Meal is a term pregnant with meaning throughout the ancient world, whether you're Christian, Jew, or other. It's an extremely important topic.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. There's a tradition now in Judaism, and I think it's more like a little tea. I've learned a lot about things that I thought were the way of Judaism. Because I grew up in the Northeast, there are lots of Jews up in the Northeast. But as I've moved around, and then I married a guy from Italy, so I learned the Italian Jewish customs. And I learned that there are some of the things that I thought were laws that everybody did were really just traditions. There is a tradition about when someone dies, you're supposed to stay with the body. Someone should stay with the body. The body shouldn't be left alone until they're buried, and you try to bury within 24 hours, which is a conversation for another day about burial. But the tradition is you don't eat or drink near that body, because it's kind of a nah, 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 nah. I can eat and you can't. And that is kind of an interesting difference there, because now I've got to go back and research about at what point, if this was the tradition of eating at the grave site, the burial site, then if that was a tradition, then how did we come to not? I've got to look that up now. You got me started on it. And I was going to share one other really bizarre tidbit here. My doctoral dissertation was in the Judaico-Romanesco, the Jewish dialect of Rome, Italy. And there's this, and I don't know a lot of it. I studied it a lot, but it's hard for me to use it here in Shreveport. But one of the phrases that I loved was something called pasta da valude, which means pasta doesn't just mean spaghetti type stuff. It also means meal. And avalut is the Hebrew word for mourning. So pasta da valud is essentially the meal that you come back to. But people will use it to say, you know, you're being mopey, you're being too mopey, stop being such a pasta da valud. And so it's kind of an expression about being kind of mopey. But that's an interesting tidbit about the meals and the dead.
The traditions that you all are talking about, how often do you do those traditions? In other words, like Father Jason, like how often do you do the communion? And I know there's traditions in Judaism too that you do on a specific regular basis. So could you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, Holy Communion is received every Sunday. That's the main day. Now, I can celebrate and have what we call the Divine Liturgy, which within it is Holy Communion. I could do it every day of the week, except during Great Lent. There's a different service we do, but I have to at least have one other person with me. So normally here at Holy Nativity, we usually have a weekday liturgy where Holy Communion is served sometimes twice a week, and then on Sunday. But Sunday is the main day. Yeah.
Okay. Rabbi?
And some of these other things were holiday-based, some of those other meals and things that you were talking about, correct?
Right.
Like yes, just holiday major, traditions.
Major feast days, we celebrate the Divine Liturgy. We receive Holy Communion. Like the next one coming up is March 25th, the Annunciation. That falls on a Thursday, so that day is a major feast day for us. So we have... I can't say this because I've got the rabbi with me, but it's Holy Communion in the morning, and then we boil crawfish in the evening. Forgive me, Rabbi.
You can say that. That's what I'm saying. I'm not better than you if I don't, and you're not better than me if you do. I'm supposed to say, I bet that's delicious. I'm sorry I can't eat it. That's what I'm supposed to say. I'm not supposed to say, you heathen, how could you possibly be eating that stuff? That's not how I feel about it, and it's not what I'm supposed to say. It's not about, God put it there. There's actually a commandment to appreciate everything that God has put in this earth. You know, did you climb mountains? Did you, it's considered one of the questions that God asks you after you die. This is kind of a judgment question. Did you take advantage? Did you set aside time to study? Did you take advantage of the things that, you know, there are avocados and peaches and kumquats. Did you taste them all? You know, I put them there so you could eat them. Did you try them? You should try it. So, you know, eat your boil your crawfish and enjoy it. And if you invite me, I'll have to, if I come, I just won't be able to eat this stuff, but I'll celebrate with you.
That'd be nice. Hey, let me go back to something real quick to Rabbi to kind of clarify something. When I'm saying the meals being eaten with the departed, okay, then that naturally for me includes the word sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Sacrifice being offered at different places. Sacrifice in our world, our context is the sharing of a meal. So when you're going through that, like in the Maccabees, y'all read the Maccabees, first, second, third Maccabees?
Hanukkah. It's the basis for our Hanukkah celebration.
That's what I thought. So
it's not, so do you have the Apocrypha as part of your scriptures?
Yeah, we follow the Septuagint. So the Greek translation of the Old Testament, really Septuagint means 70. The translation by the
about 70 Christ,
but it really has to do with the Torah. That's the Septuagint nowadays means the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, but really Septuagint means Torah translation. The other books were translated into Greek as well, what, 200 years before the birth of Jesus. So
the Hebrew scriptures don't include I was thinking about the Apocrypha because we have our scriptures are what are called the Tanakh, Torah, prophets, and writings. And the right. And then we appreciate the Apocrypha as almost scriptures. But I know that the Catholic Church takes the Apocrypha as part of their scriptures, as part of their Bible, we'll call it. And right. And so it sounds like you do all as well. But those stories are obviously important to us. They are still the foundation of some of our holidays.
Sure.
And I'm going to try to clarify. I think sometimes when people think of holy days, they define them as feasts. That's a translation for holy day is a feast, which implies food. We say festival. I'm sure that the word festival must have come from feast also. But it's not how I see it as feast days, but I'm starting to, after what you said about God creating us to be eating creatures, I'm starting to see life in a different way. Starting to get hungry, maybe.
Yeah,
so is it lunchtime yet?
Hey, it's getting close to lunchtime. We can all go eat.
your canon, your Hebrew canon is the Masoretic text, right?
Right.
Okay, yeah. And so ours is the Septuagint, say Septuagint.
And which is, so for us, the Masoretic text is before it got translated. So what the Masoretes did, and it was a cool thing, and it's something has nothing to do with food though, Marcy. So we may have to do another whole thing about scriptures. But so you know that Hebrew was written without vowels. And one of the things that the Masoretes did was they added vowels and punctuation, and trope marks, which are marks that help us know the accented syllable, the phrasings, and the melodies to sing. It became something we sing, and all of the scriptures have these markings that the Masoretes did, which when I teach Hebrew is such a glorious thing, because the rules about the vowels were imposed long after the words were there. And so it is an incredibly regular language. And I love teaching it. And I will keep saying Hebrew is easy, because the more I say Hebrew is easy to learn, the more people have to believe me and they have to learn it, and it'll be easy for them. That's what I say. But Masoretic text is not about a translation. It's about still using the Hebrew, but they vocalized it and set apart the phrases. So for example, if you look at the Decalogue, the fact that they separated out certain parts will make things feel different sometimes than the translation that you read. I always suggest not reading the translation. I always suggest reading the original. There are all these things and nuances that you lose.
When was the Masoretic text compiled and put together?
It was only hundreds of years ago. You were asking me to make up a number. I could look it up for you.
Yeah, because I'm trying to remember myself. Is it 5th or 6th century AD?
I was going to say the 400s. That's what I was going to say. But
I'm trying to remember myself. Yeah,
we can look that up. Marcy, are you on your computer? No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, Father, answer the next question. I'll look it up. But I'm embarrassed for our listeners. They're probably looking it up faster than we are. We're sitting here looking at each other instead of looking up things. But I always tell my congregation, if you ask me a history question, like a date or a name, I will sometimes proudly try to fake it, but I'm not going to try to fake it today.
Let's try to get within a few hundred years. We're close. Yeah.
But the point is, it was recently. I mean, in some sense of, if the Hebrew tradition, if the scriptures were written over 400 years ago, Torah was 4,000 years ago, the Masoretes added these vowels not very long ago, within, just a few hundred years. And it doesn't mean that the text changed. In fact, part of their intention was to make the text stay the same. Languages change and words change and the pronunciation changes. And they were trying to make sure that the scriptures did not change. Yes.
It's very interesting that today's topic was food. And I have heard more words that I've never heard before in this conversation. So I've written some of them down so that we can say, what's that mean?
Right. We got, and anytime you hear words you didn't know, we'll translate it again. Well, stop us. It's not helpful for people to not know what we're talking about. It's part of what my linguistics doctoral degree, I try very hard to speak in ways that people understand. And that's a difficult question. When you're asking about fasting and foods, for example, we all have to hear it from our own perspective. And sometimes the words that we use, if they're the same words, we get excited about hearing similar words that we're familiar with, but sometimes we mean something very different.
We have just a few minutes left, but there's a very important question that I want to ask. And if we could briefly talk about it, we'll go ahead and talk about it in depth another day. But it's about fasting. And the thing that I want to ask is, what is the purpose of fasting in your faith?
Well, since you're in the middle of a fast period right now, you want to take it first?
Sure. For whatever reason, God has tied our spiritual life in and through our bellies. Okay. So when we overeat, we become lethargic, not just, maybe emotionally or physically, but spiritually as well. So when we focus on not eating as much, we focus on fasting, I would say in some way what Rabbi often says, we're giving up something that we may offer up something else. And so when someone begins to get hungry and they can identify with the hunger that's in the world, they can identify with the spiritual hunger within themselves and the need for God to actually feed them, the mind becomes a lot clearer, things become more spiritually in tune. And there's a training in that as well. And I'm trying to be brief. if I can say no to something like, okay, I'm not going to eat those cookies.
Chocolate.
It sounds really simple. I'm not going to eat that. But I'm training my will to listen to me. And I'm training myself spiritually to say no. So when some other greater temptation comes my way, then through this spiritual training, this ascesis, as we call it, I'm training myself to say no to those things as well and maintain my communion and my relationship with God. So it's multifaceted, but those are things I would say practically, that's one of the main reasons for the feast or fasting itself. And then when I am fed and when I do celebrate the feast, it's often done with a greater sense of thanksgiving and fullness and realization that all good things come from God, right? And so there's a lot that goes into it, but that's briefly, I would say that.
How many times a year does the church fast?
The Orthodox Church, outside of most every Wednesday and Friday, because the ancient Jews fasted on Tuesday and Thursday, if I remember correctly, okay? Then we have four major fasting periods during the year. So we have the Great Fast, which is Great Lent. Then
it's now, isn't it, Father? It's now the Great Lent.
For the Western Church, they're in the middle of it. Our dating of Pascha or Easter is different. So we're a month behind the Western Church. We don't celebrate Pascha till May 2nd this year, which is, we're 4 weeks behind. That's a whole nother conversation. So we have that fast, and however long, wherever the dating of Pascha is for the year determines how long the Apostles' fast can be. It can be 2 weeks or 2 days. And then we get into the Dormition Fast in August 1st through the 15th. And that has to do with Mary, the mother of Jesus, her falling asleep. And then the last major fasting period of the year is the Nativity Fast. And that's the 40 days before December 25th on our calendar. Yeah. So those are the four main fasts during the year outside of every Wednesday and every Friday.
Okay, Rabbi, quickly, we need to go ahead and get some time for you to talk about Jewish fasting.
So the Jewish fasting usually happens for introspective and sad things. We just had Purim, which is the commemoration of the story of the book of Esther. And Esther asked everybody to fast because she was hoping to avoid the Jews being murdered. And she said, we've got to fast to be able to prep for that. And so there's a tradition of that. Many, many festivals have a tradition about fasting. I'm going to be honest with you about when the majority of Jews fast now on Yom Kippur. That's the primary fast. It's mandated in the Torah that it's supposed to be a day of affliction. We have five fasts for us. The fasts are not eating, not drinking, no leather, no bathing or anointing, and no sex. Those five things are our fasts for that day. Typically, a fast includes all of those things.
Yes.
Those things are never more than 27-ish hours. It's a day of fasting. And one of the spiritual connections to it, ironically, given with what we just said, and most people don't always think about this. Obviously, some of the things the Father said, it also helps us when we're hungry. If we're aware of our hunger, hopefully it also allows us to be aware of the hunger in the world right now and be people who take care of each other better. But there's also, like, especially for Yom Kippur, there's a sense of kind of practicing to be dead. To die, that you are, it's as if you are not a physical body anymore. You're thinking only about your spiritual sense, and spirits don't need food. There's a tradition about wearing white, so it's kind of similar to wearing the shroud that you'd be buried in. We pray all day. We're not thinking about our physical body at all. We're thinking about our spiritual body, our spiritual spirit. And so so we don't need food or water. We're not worried about any of those things. And we got this.
Fasting automatically brings into the equation for us prayer and almsgiving. So mm-hmm. It ties together.
Yeah. And so what struck me about the question about fasting, Marcy, when I saw that you wanted to ask this, And it ties in with eating and what foods we're allowed to eat and not allowed to eat. And it ties into the fact that humans get to make choices in ways that other animals and other creatures don't. And that to be human means to make choices, but to be a human of faith, it means that the choices you make are guided by God. And so for me, when I keep kosher, it's because I think that God tells me that this is what God wants me to do. And when I, if I fast, I do it because it was kind of God mandated. It's a commandment. I live by that. It's the covenant that I have with God, that God asks me to do these things and I do them. And I get meaning from the fact that as a human, as I kind of point, I said it, Father said it a different way, but we have appetites. We have these, you know, there's all this in the world and we have to make choices. And sometimes the choices restrict us from appreciating everything in the world. But somehow by not having and not doing, and in this case, not eating, makes us realize we're holier. It connects us to God in ways. It's an interesting connection to think that I think I thought of it as like a control. Can I control myself? And when I do, I am living a more godly way. If I can control myself and my nature and some of my desires are to make bad choices, but if I can control that, I'm living in a godly way. And I think that the food, so we have some foods that are celebratory. So like I said, you know, so for Hanukkah, we eat foods that have to do with oil because there was the miracle of the oil. But that's not the point here. The point is there are foods that God tells us to eat and foods God tells us not to eat. There are times when God would rather not have us eat. And then we learn lessons from that.
That is a beautiful way to stop. We're out of time. And I had 19 questions we were going to talk about, and we actually covered 4. So we will be
talking. I think you'd be surprised. I think that when you look back, you'll notice that we covered just about everything.
Yes, it was a wonderful, wonderful time with you both. And I thank you for your presence. I thank you for your wisdom. I thank you for your faith and your journey of faith. And I thank you for being a part of this. This has been an hour filled with life-giving love from all of you. Thank you so much for your participation today. We've had the pleasure of talking with Rabbi Jana and Father Jason. You've been listening to About Faith on Red River Radio. I hope you enjoyed meeting with our panel today as much as I have. If you have any questions that you would like for the panel to address, email us at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Be sure that you tune in to Red River Radio next Sunday at 1:00 for Illuminations. And don't forget to tune in 2 weeks from now for more conversations about faith. And there will be many more topics that we go forward in learning about the people of faith in our community. This is Marcy Howard with lots more questions about faith. Thank you for being with us.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Red River Radio, our staff or advisory board, or LSUS.